Dr. Cooper and Dr. Johanna could join us on stage, we can begin to take some questions.
While people are coming to the podium, I want to make a comment that I think certainly there is a population that needs to be studied on less immunosuppressives or no immunosuppressives. The way I would do it is I would still give them induction therapy, but not give them maintenance. See if they relapse on maintenance. I think that's safer. I think you'd have a hard time saying to your, if it was your father or mother or yourself, that you didn't want therapy, you know, to be in that first group.
I agree. I think that there is a practice in some centers to treat the patients with rituximab induction without any maintenance, namely anti-MPO patients, and it seems that it works very well. But on the other hand, anti-PRC positive patients with external manifestation definitely need long-term maintenance treatment, which may be even longer than 2 years, which is generally recommended.
Well, while people are coming to the microphone, are they there? They're not. Then I have a comment for Dr. Cooper. So I actually knew two of the people in your slides personally. Now, one you can guess was Keith Reemsema, who came as head of surgery as a transplant person, brought transplant to Columbia, and that was 1973, because I was a first-year resident that year. But I knew somebody else in 1973, Charles Lindbergh. Now, people say, oh, you must be 100 years old. No, Lindbergh was at the very end of his life. He had a lymphoma. I mean, this is not a HIPAA violation. Was being treated. As a resident, I treated Charles Lindbergh. And I can say, it took a day and a half for him to get a spinal tap because he was Charles Lindbergh and he had Listeria meningitis. And I wrote down that he needed a spinal tap when I saw him right away. But anecdote.
Yeah.
And the other thing, but I would, you know, the progress in pig transplant seems to be slower than the progress in new medications. You know, one thing, you know, you had your thing about cardiac surgeons in the beginning and taking out the small brain part. You know, surgeons are pretty aggressive. Transplant surgeons are pretty aggressive. And, we're just using abatacept and a bunch of things. They've been using belatacept for a long time already. They're ahead of us. They used an anti-CD40, you know, like in lupus patients. I mean, they just jump in and use the drugs. I mean, it seems like anything you study in pigs, they will have done in people beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, certainly transplant people are pretty aggressive. I think the problems with xeno have been very considerable, and that's why it's taken us. I've been involved for more than 30 years in it, and we've only the last two or three years really got where we're thinking we're getting to get into the clinic. But I think it will come about, and I don't think drugs will solve the problem of those initial high levels of antibody against the pig. In the old days, if we just gave the drugs, it made no difference at all. So I think we have to have the genetically engineered pigs. I think that makes the big breakthrough.
Yes, there's a question from the audience.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed the talk. I take the opportunity to ask the two glomerular experts. First of all, just a comment. Charles Lindbergh is from Minnesota.
The airport's named after him.
But question is, do you see a relapse of P-ANCA, PR3 antibody ANCA relapse manifest as no microscopic hematuria but leukocyturia? The reason I'm asking is I had a patient who has some sign of a relapse in the joints. But make a long story short, she has 20 years history of very high titer of a PR3 and had cytoxin treatment, and along the line, she had a relapse, was RBC cast, and treated with Rituxan. And then she was essentially just monitoring and recently had some non-specific joint issue, and I sent her to the rheumatologist, she's fine. But look at the urine, and she has again and again leukocyturia.
Okay, I'll go first. So let me say, for monitoring the patients, I follow the ANCA titer, and I also follow the sedimentation rate, which I do in the lupus patients too. Now, Ron Falk, who didn't used to do that, something like about 5 years ago, he said he's doing it too now, because a lot of people run a high anti-DNA antibody with lupus or a high ANCA with RPGN, and it's up there all the time, but they're clinically quiescent. So it's another marker you have of nonspecific inflammation that I personally, you know, if people are quiescent in other systems, and I can tell you, you know, before there was an ANCA, there were SED rates. The first paper I wrote when I left Columbia for Yale in 1976 was on all their patients with Wegeners at Yale, 18 in the entire history of the institution, because they had no ANCA. But they all had high SED rates. They were all anemic. They had high rheumatoid factors. They were sick. I mean, these people were sick, and if they're not sick and they don't have those findings, they don't have the anemia, et cetera, it's much less likely, and white cells alone would be unusual unless it's just a chronic disease here. That
no.
The red cells, the problem is they've all gotten Cytoxan in the past, and they all have microhematuria from their bladder problems.
That's the issue. She's always had a sky-high sedimentation rate, and her PR3 is always greater than 8. She's just never coming down to even to the range. And that's the problem. I did the biopsy.
I agree what was already said. I think that you do not read the title of ANCA. So there are some patients who are positive all the time, even after treatment, and if they are stable with no clinical signs of the disease, they should be only monitored and follow up. Because there are even some data, for instance, by Cohen-Tervat, showing that if you treat them preemptively, it has no good impact on the course of the disease. And concerning the urinary finding, in fact, in my experience, renal relapses are either undiagnosed or not so much frequent. What we usually see as major relapses are pulmonary relapses. There are many pulmonary relapses. And this is the main indication for rituximab in relapsing patients, at least in my center. And concerning the urinary finding, I agree that with only leukocyturia, I would clearly not treat the patient if there are no other signs of the activity of the disease.
Yeah. But you did what I would do. Same thing, lupus or vasculitis. If you're not certain, do the biopsy.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the bottom line.
Yeah.
So
okay.
In her, the trigger for the biopsy, it's really not impressive other than leukocyturia. But her creatinine level for the last almost 20 years being initial bump and then coming down to around 1.2, 1.3 for many years. And then it went up to 1.4, and 1.4, 1.5 coming down to 1.4. So we were not so sure, and did a biopsy, and she had new crescents.
It happens. You know, that's why you did the biopsy. So you have, if they're cellular crescents, then you have good validation to treat. And especially if they're older and they've had a relapse, I tend to make sure they stay on the maintenance therapy, because I'm always worried that the next relapse will throw them on dialysis. Or if it's a pulmonary relapse, they're in big trouble.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to move on to the next question. What does it mean when both PR3 and MPO titers are elevated?
Can you repeat the question?
Both.
What does it mean when both PR3 and MPO titers are elevated?
Okay. The first thing I think of is drug-induced disease. So if you take medication-induced diseases, and there are certain drugs that are classic for it, but if you get both, we see this in the addicted population that's getting everything cut with levamisole, whatever they're injecting into themselves, it's cut with levamisole. They get dual block, double. Some of the hydralazine-induced ANCA vasculitis, it used to be, you know, when we saw somebody who had an active urinary sediment, you know, and it looked like they had glomerulonephritis and they were on hydralazine, the most common thing was lupus, even though it was rare. Now it's becoming ANCA-positive disease by far, and some of those are double positive. So I think at least medication-induced would be the top of my list. Now, of the medications that do it, most of them just give you MPO positive, like the antithyroid drugs. They give you, you know, just an MPO positive and not a PR3, especially in China. But that's the first thing I think of, especially in an addict.
It probably also depends how the lab has the upper limit of normal, because the double positivity is uncommon. But sometimes you see that you have a patient who is clearly anti-PRC positive and may have borderline anti-MPO, for instance, probably because of some treatment or so. But to have very high titer of both is very, very uncommon. Yeah.
I don't know if Vladimir agrees on this, but when I see a high titer PR3, I'm always very suspicious it's the real thing, that I'm missing something. When I see a high titer MPO, they have psoriasis or ulcerative colitis or some other immune disease.
I agree.
I have a question for Dr. Cooper myself. drugs are certainly tried in experimental animals and then tried in humans if they're found to be safe. How do you overcome the barrier of having a xenotransplant work in an experimental animal to the first human subject?
Well, we've just started contact with the FDA to see what they will expect. They put out a list of guidelines some years ago, and they modified it more recently, but nobody quite knows what they will demand or expect from the trial. But I think if we've shown that the genetically engineered pigs are clean from a microbiological point of view, that's their main concern, I think. If we've shown some efficacy in a non-human primate model, I think that's their second concern. So I think they'll be realistic about it and realize that this may solve this donor shortage problem if we can do it. Now, we're trying to use only drugs that are FDA approved. We've got one drug we use at the minute which is not FDA approved, which is by far the best drug, but we're trying to replace it with FDA approved drugs. So they've only then got to consider the pig, then got to consider the drug as well. I think that may complicate things.
It looks more like a comment to Dr. Johanna. The problem is not the patient. Every patient wants a kidney transplant. The highest incentive to escape from the misery of dialysis. The problem is the transplant centers reject many patients who are overweight. Do you see that as a problem?
I think every transplant center, and maybe this is a problem, is that we don't coordinate our eligibility criteria for a referral. So in Ontario, we don't have a specific BMI in that case. It is sort of center-specific, so that can be a concern that we all don't coordinate our efforts and decide on a specific BMI. But I think the problem is actually multifaceted. I don't think it's all just the transplant center, but we definitely have our role in it as well.
George, there's a question out there.
Yes.
Hello. My name is Reis. Thank you very much for an excellent talk. I have a question. Now, in elderly population, MGR is coming up, and we have case reports where MGR is present as ANCA-vasculites. So in that case, like, how can we know that the monoclonal antibody is the one which is acting as ANCA and giving ANCA-vasculites? In that case, should we treat the monoclonal gammopathy by itself or the ANCA-vasculites?
The MGR is monoclonal gammopathy of renal significance. Yes. Well, this is a big challenge for us right now at Columbia, and is it the Mayo too, is that for a different disease, but that is in the people with C3 glomerulopathy, because if you take the older population, many of them will have what used to be an MGUS, but now may be a monoclonal gammopathy of renal significance, and it's acting as an autoantibody, and it either binds to factor H or binds to factor I, so the complement, you're blocking the inhibitors of the, you know, alternative pathway, and that's why these people, you know, when somebody who's 55 years old gets stents deposit disease, they're not the same disease as the 18-year-old or the 22-year-old who has a genetic defect. They have an antibody or something. It's been very hard to show that those antibodies or their spike is related to the disease. There are certainly a handful of cases, but we've had a lot of trouble doing it, but we feel that, and we do treat them. You know, I mean, these people now, as the therapy gets better for these diseases, they're getting bortezomib, but the big thing, I think, is daratumumab, the monoclonal antibody that they're using in myeloma and amyloid. I think that's going to make a major difference because, again, just makes it a little more benign. You don't have to worry about neuropathy. So I think, you know, if you had the same situation, which I don't usually have in ANCA positive, I probably would,
you know, lean towards that.
Yeah. There are many overlaps between ANCA-associated vasculitis and other glomerular diseases. Some we see quite frequently, for instance, IgA nephropathy with ANCA positivity. In China, they repeatedly reported ANCA-associated vasculitis with membranous nephropathy, which is not common in Europe. I don't know if it is here common, but in Europe it's very uncommon. And concerning this co-occurrence with monoclonal gammopathy, I would definitely be interested in renal biopsy or performed re-biopsy, because I'm not sure that it has any clinical meaning and any clinical sense. And, of course, it's very unclear if it is related to ANCA-associated vasculitis.
Especially because this is an older population, yeah, and the incidence, yeah, of monoclonal gammopathies goes up tremendously. I mean, like, you know, they just had that article in the New England Journal of the re-review by the Mayo Group following over time. It's a big percentage.
Maybe a coincidence by chance.
I'm willing to bet that one of the people standing up here has a monoclonal gammopathy by age.
Actually, for the two of you again, apart from serum creatinine of 4.5 that indicates a worse renal outcome, is there any other determinant of a poor renal outcome outside of the baseline serum creatinine?
Age. Oh, on creatinine. Wait.
Creatinine 4.5, which was shown in the slide.
4.5, you know, like, but that's, you know, people have found different things, because I think it was 3.2 in your study, that an elevated creatinine is always worse. You know, the higher it is, the worse they do. The older the age, the worse they do. You know, it may be side effects. I think the biggest thing is that you can see this wasn't a vigorous debate, because we're both looking at the same. The data is the data. The question is, how can we reduce the complications? And I think they're going to go way down with rituximab as we learn to use it. The rheumatologists are so used to rituximab. I mean, they've given, you know, like 250,000 patients in the United States have gotten rituximab for rheumatoid arthritis. You know, all these side effects that we've been worried about, you know, we were told about PML. There are 8 cases in the 250,000 people with PML and rheumatoid arthritis, and they're all people who got other drugs as well. I mean, like, so the risks are not that great.
What is also an open issue is that in these patients with 4.5 milligrams per deciliter of serum creatinine, if these patients are to be treated with plasma exchange or not. Because there is now a finished, very large study, Pexivas, the data are not yet available, and it should give us an information if also the patients who have better preserved renal function, serum creatinine lower than 5 milligrams per deciliter, also benefit from treatment. And there may be even difference between anti-PRC and anti-MPO patients. Anti-PRC may respond better. So this is a very open question.
Another question. Can we treat based on ANCA positivity and clinically active disease without a biopsy? Do you feel that a biopsy is necessary?
Yeah. There is an increasing proportion of centers in Europe who are treating patients without biopsy. And our practice is that sometimes we also treat without biopsy. If the patient is suffering from alveolar hemorrhage, it's very difficult to biopsy him immediately or her immediately. But what we do is that usually we perform a delayed biopsy after 6 weeks or 8 weeks after the clinical status of the patient is improving, because we are always interested what is the expected renal outcome. What is the percentage of sclerosis? If there is still any activity, if the maintenance treatment is important and must be long or short and so on. So I am in favor of biopsy.
I agree that, I mean, there are people that you wouldn't want a biopsy. If somebody is just too sick for a biopsy, now they have to be pretty sick, because a kidney biopsy, I mean, we biopsied people on respirators and sitting in all kinds of crazy ways, and it's more benign than some of the other stuff they do. The other thing is, if somebody is already on maximal therapy, they have hemoptysis, red cells, and you already say, okay, this guy's getting, you know, pulse solumedrol, a dose of Cytoxan or rituximab, and plasma exchange, the biopsy is great to know, but it's not going to add anything. You're already on maximal therapy. It may be better doing the repeat biopsy. You know, in as they always said, there was a famous nephropathologist, Gary Hill, who said in lupus that if you can only do one biopsy on your lupus patient, make it the second biopsy.
I believe that it will be substantially helped with the new biomarkers, which will probably be able to distinguish between active and inactive disease, and even could be specifically related to different glomerular presentations, such as crescents, fibrosis, and so on. they are under development. And
we get the biopsy back faster than we get the anchor back. including the IFNDEM.
Okay. Did you do a quality of life questionnaire on the patients? Is there a difference in quality of life depending upon which type of therapy, whether Rituxan or cyclophosphamide is used? At least that's what I believe this question is.
You know, I'd be willing to bet there was something in the RAVE trial, but, you know, but I wasn't one of the authors of that. We were too busy with our lupus trials. I can tell you in the MENTOR trial and membranous, which was cyclosporin versus rituximab, where I think the rituximab came out significantly better. That was just presented at the ASN. There is a lot of quality of life data because in terms of getting a drug approved, that is one of the ways of getting it approved by the FDA. You've either got to show survival, a big change in creatinine, or quality of life. If the patients feel better, that's why I always say in rheumatoid arthritis, there are 30 drugs approved in the last few years. If your patient walks across the room faster, the FDA approves the drug. In nephrology, you've got to get the creatinine down, the protein down, hard numbers, but quality of life is important, I think.
What is also very important from the point of view of patient is that the treatment with rituximab is so easy. It means one infusion once half a year, and it's also very good from the point of view of compliance or adherence. You are sure that the patient really is treated, which is not the case with all cyclophosphamide, all corticosteroids, and so on.
I think we have time for one more question. If a patient develops a severe infection during the induction therapy, what do you recommend for continued treatment?
The two big problems for me in glomerular disease are, one, if the person gets an infection during the time, you know, is treatment indicated or not? And the other is when they get pregnant in the middle of the thing, and then you have the same kind of problems. I think the answer was on, you know, one of Vladimir's slides. It may have been the last one, individualized therapy. How bad is the infection? You don't want to kill the people with the immunosuppression. Now, if they're going to go on dialysis, okay. Dialysis is dialysis, and you can get them a transplant later on. On the other hand, if you're going to kill them with the immunosuppression, then it's probably a better idea not to treat.
Even if you have severe infection in patients, for instance, with alveolar hemorrhage, and you must treat him, you can do something. You can use high-dose corticosteroids. You can use plasma exchange. You can use high-dose intravenous immunoglobulins, and possibly you can even use rituximab, which is probably less toxic in this acute situation compared to cyclophosphamide. We would never give cyclophosphamide in this situation of severe infection, but otherwise almost everything is possible.
I think we're finished with the questions. Crystal? Okay, after lunch. We're going to get an instruction on how to use our app.
Yes, and we'll do that, George, I think we're going to give you your PhD back. If everybody could turn to page 25 and remove my PhD and give it to George.
Thank you.
He's back where he belongs.
Yeah.
Say hello to Alice.
Well,
okay, thank you all.
Thank you.